case for the December arguments. This is 98-2062 CR, State v. Warren v. Floyd, David D. Leeper representing Mr. Floyd.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the court. My name is Dave Leeper, and I represent the appellant in this action, Warrick Floyd. We are here today because Mr. Floyd spent 157 days in jail in Rock County because he was indigent, and he received no sentence credit for those days on any prison sentence. The question before this court is whether Mr. Floyd is entitled to credit for those days spent in jail, or whether those days are simply to be ignored as if they don't mean anything. The issue of sentence credit for indigent defendants is a constitutional issue of equal protection, and it has been recognized by this court. You articulated the issue clearly in Climas v. State when you said, "There is no constitutionally sufficient reason to permit the pretrial discrimination on the basis of wealth to go unrectified, if it is at all possible to do so. The obvious method of rectifying the inequality is to credit the pre-conviction time in partial fulfillment of the sentence imposed upon conviction." The legislature also has recognized that this is an issue of fundamental justice when it provided for a broad recognition of sentence credit as a matter of state law in section 973.155. 973.155 provides, quote, "A convicted offender shall be given credit toward the service of his or her sentence for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed." This court and the legislature have both addressed the issue of sentence credit because it's an issue of fundamental fairness. The state has the power to take a person out of his home and lock that person up in jail, and that is an awesome power. It is a power that must be exercised only with the greatest care and concern for those whose lives are disrupted by the power. Mr. Floyd spent 157 days in jail on an armed robbery charge because he could not post cash bail. The armed robbery charge was dismissed as part of a plea bargain and formally read in for sentencing on a reckless endangering charge. Mr. Floyd never received any credit at all for those 157 days he spent in jail. Mr. Floyd is entitled to sentence credit for that time, and there are three different ways this court can reach that conclusion. The first way is that I believe 973.155 is ambiguous as written and requires statutory interpretation by this court. It provides sentence credit for, quote, "any course of conduct," end quote, "for which," quote, "sentence was imposed," end quote. The question in this case is whether there's any connection between the armed robbery conduct and the five-year prison sentence imposed on the reckless endangering conviction.
Now, your position, just going into your brief, is basically that because it was a read-in, armed robbery was a read-in, that of course it was considered by the judge, therefore it was in connection with that. That's your fundamental argument.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Obviously the state says no, it has to be in connection with the course of conduct. But a broad reading, I think, as I understand it, is what you want of the statute, and that you're asking for that interpretation.
I want a broad reading, in particularly broad on two grounds. One is, this is remedial legislation. It was specifically passed to address this court's response in Climas v. State. And remedial legislation should be interpreted to accomplish that purpose. The other canon of statutory interpretation would be the rule of lenity, which requires that when there is an ambiguity or a dispute, it's to be resolved in favor of the defendant.
Then we'd have to overturn the Beiersdorf case, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You don't think so?
No.
Why not?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that any court has yet interpreted this particular statute as to whether a sentence credit should be offered when a case is part of a plea bargain and is read in for sentence credit.
And that's what distinguishes, because this is a case of first impression that came here on certification.
I believe so, Your Honor.
How about this? Now, the Beiersdorf case did define in connection with, right? I mean, that's what it focused on. Is that correct?
I believe so.
And the Beiersdorf said this means a factual connection, not a procedural connection. So you've got problems with that, I think.
Well, Your Honor, I do, and I'm relying primarily on Sarkowitz as a case in which the court has established a connection and has recognized a connection that exists very strongly between read-in sentences in this state. You know, this state has a procedure for read-ins that is different from other states. The defendant in that case actually admits to the crimes which are read in.
Do you distinguish then Beiersdorf by saying it wasn't a read-in and Sarkowitz was dealt with read-ins? Is that correct?
I believe the fact that this is a read-in case is absolutely essential. I'm asking this court only to address the question of what to do when there's a read-in case as part of a plea bargain where sentence credit is approved.
But the Beiersdorf case defined what in connection means. And it says it means factual, not procedural. It didn't say, oh, as applied only to felonies or misdemeanors or read-ins or the definition.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that I don't believe that that's the only way of reading in connection with. And I think that the Sarkowitz court and I think that the Court of Appeals in this particular case has addressed that particular issue, that it says it could be in the course of conduct is whatever is related to that sentence. That creates a connection.
Well, that's the second part of the statute when you're talking about the term confinement related to an offense. That's a different phrase, right?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the second part of the statute is important at all in this particular case. I think the first sentence covers entirely the issue before the court. The second part simply tries to address what in custody is about, and it lists several things that are in custody. But in this particular case, there's no question that Mr. Floyd was in custody. He was in the Rock County Jail, and I believe it's only the very first sentence of 973.155 that is, you know, relevant to this court's decision.
Why aren't you arguing it's the second sentence? Why aren't you arguing? I mean, you can argue whatever you want. I'm just asking. Because related to is a much broader term.
Well, Your Honor, as I...
It hasn't been, and then you don't have to try to get around case law.
Your Honor, I agree, but I need to be honest and consistent in how I read the statute, and I read 973.155, paragraph 1A. Only the first sentence sets the rule and requirement for the court. Anything else, it says, as the next sentence then begins, as used in this subsection, actual days spent in custody includes, and then it describes actual days spent in custody. That's not an issue in this particular case. Everyone knows that he spent the days in custody because of the armed robbery. I think this is just clarifying this particular phrase, actual days spent in custody, from the sentence above it.
So you're reading out, of course, in connection with. In other words, you stop at all days spent in custody.
I would say all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. And that completes the first sentence of 973-155. That's the particular sentence that I think it's important that this court interpret, and I'm relying on the Sarkowitz case primarily, which interpreted a sentence very similar in 1990, and it said that when you're talking about course of conduct for which sentence was imposed, what you mean in that case is all of the conduct that was considered at the time of sentencing. And in this case, there's no question that the armed robbery conduct was considered at the time of sentencing. That's the basis of my argument, particularly on the statutory construction.
Mr. Leeper, you had started out by indicating you felt the statute was ambiguous. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
One of the things that we look at, as you know, if there's a determination that the statute is ambiguous, is legislative history. Is there any legislative history that supports the position that you're taking?
Your Honor, I have looked at the legislative history, and I have some of that with me here today. I don't believe there's anything in the legislative history that indicates whether the legislature was thinking about read-ins or not. And again, I would like to address what happened in the Sarkowitz case. In that case, the language said, you may order restitution in relationship to the crime. The court in Sarkowitz read the crime. It said this is ambiguous. Does it mean the crime of conviction, or does it mean the crime that the court considered in sentencing? And that court said, it's ambiguous, we're going to interpret it broadly. It means any crime that was part of the sentencing consideration. The legislature then took a look at that in 1991, again in 93 and 95, and amended the section, I think it's 973.20, on restitution, to adopt this particular court's language, or excuse me, the Court of Appeals language and decision that it should be interpreted broadly. And then the legislature specifically included a read-ins when it amended that statute. That's exactly the position that we're at today, and that's exactly what I'm urging this court to do. To say, yes, this is ambiguous in this case, the same way that 973.20 was ambiguous in 1990. We have to interpret it because of Mr. Floyd's case. When you interpret it, the legislature then has the ability either to confirm and say, yes, that's what we meant, like they did in response to Sarkowitz, or they can say, no, that's not what we meant. We only meant the crime of conviction.
Now, in Sarkowitz, did the court take the position that in connection with was to be interpreted broadly so that restitution could be ordered even for a read-in?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And you feel that that's really analogous to the situation we're faced with today?
I think it's very analogous. And in Sarkowitz in particular, provided for restitution under the crime. As I'm looking at the statutes, the 8990 Wisconsin statutes, it says that court shall order the defendant to make full or partial restitution under this section to any victim of the crime, or if the victim is deceased. The statute today now reads this way. It says, when imposing sentence, the court, in addition to any other penalty, shall order the defendant to make full or partial restitution under this section to any victim of a crime considered at sentencing. See, the language was changed to clarify that it means any crime considered at sentencing. And the reason it did that is because the particularly strong position that Wisconsin has taken on read-in sentences.
can tell me what that position is as you understand it, Mr. Lee.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that this court in, excuse me, let me find the reference. I believe it's State v. Evans. It's Austin v. State. Austin v. State, 49 Wisconsin 2nd, 727. And the Court of Appeals in Sarkowitz relied on that Supreme Court case when it said, quote, in Wisconsin, when a defendant agrees to a crime being read in at the time of sentencing, he makes an admission that he committed those crimes. The trial court considers these read-ins as part of the defendant's conduct for sentencing purposes, and the state is prohibited from later formally charging the defendant for these criminal offenses. And the reason, of course, end of quote, but the reason, of course, that the state is prohibited from charging the defendant again is because of double jeopardy implications. Because the defendant was actually punished for that conduct. Because of our read-in procedure in Wisconsin, the defendant is punished for that conduct. Mr. Floyd is being punished right now for his armed robbery conduct, and that's the reason that the state can't bring another charge against him on the armed robbery.
Would it make any difference if the armed robbery charge was not read in but simply dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor, it would make a great deal of difference. If that charge was simply dismissed and was not part of the basis of that sentence, then I would not consider that to be closely enough connected.
What if the facts of the sentence of the crime for which he was charged were related to the armed robbery, but just as part of the plea bargain, they dismissed it and didn't read it in?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that would be the easiest case. If Mr. Floyd was charged with reckless endangering, perhaps for brandishing a weapon or something, at the same time he was involved in an armed robbery, the actual same factual circumstance.
Same course of conduct.
Yeah, then I think there's no question that he would automatically get sentence credit under any reading of the statute. If it was factually part of the same course of conduct, he would certainly receive that sentence credit.
That's under the first and second sentence.
All right, I'm sure it is. It's a.
But says on, or in, for any other sentence arising out of the same course of conduct.
Yes.
While I'm looking at it, I noticed that the words used are, shall be given credit to the service of his or her sentence for all days spent in custody. And then the next sentence starts out, as used in this subsection, actual days spent in custody includes. I haven't been able to find it where they use the word actual days spent in custody. Have I missed it?
Well, Your Honor, if you missed it, I did too. I was kind of confused as to, it appears to me they're trying to quote from the sentence right above.
But they missed on
I agree that they missed the exact quotation on that.
Right.
I don't find any other reference. It makes sense that they're trying to quote the
sometimes
sentence
it's
before.
Hard to quote the sentence.
That's right. It's hard to quote it accurately. Are there any questions on this particular issue? If not, I'd like to go on to the other basis. I would like to point out perhaps closing up an introduction to the statutory interpretation. The statute does say any course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. It does not say any course of conduct upon which the conviction was based. It could have said that. It could have said any course of conduct upon which the conviction was based. But the legislature chose to say any course of conduct upon which sentence was imposed, which to me seems to be broader, certainly can be read broader than any case upon which conviction was had. The second basis for granting sentence credit is the constitutional mandate for equal protection under the law. Mr. Floyd is a poor young man who was held in jail for 157 days because he could not pay $15,000 cash bond. Equal protection demands that Mr. Floyd not be punished more severely than would a person of moderate wealth who was able to post this bail. This equal protection argument also provides significant support to the statutory interpretation that we are urging. The statute was clearly developed in response to Klimas and several other cases that indicated there's a constitutional issue here. And I believe that this court needs to take into consideration the equal protection argument even as it determines how to interpret the statute in that case.
Well, if we decided on the statute, we don't have to go to equal protection, though, right? Well,
that's true. That's true. And that would be the first place to look, I believe, is the statutory interpretation. I think the equal protection argument is strongest in that it supports the statutory interpretation that we are suggesting. The third basis for providing sentence credit in this case is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Can I just stop you on equal protection? This statute is limited, as you pointed out, to the course of conduct in which sentence was imposed, not course of conduct of the conviction.
That's correct.
So if this hadn't been a read-in, then you'd have to worry about whether it's out of the same course of conduct, or you might have two separate crimes, brandishing the gun, to use Justice Babbage's example, and then many minutes later the same day, doing armed robbery. And after the armed robbery is dismissed, let us say, not read in,
yes,
and the only conviction and the only thing on the sentence is brandishing the weapon, yet the person may have stayed in jail, trying to think of a situation where there were two sets of bails, one for one offense and one for the other, and they're not overlapping times. I mean,
yes.
I'm so evaluating or getting that kind of example, but you can see what I'm driving at, and the result is if he had the money, he'd be out on both.
That's true. I think what Your Honor is getting at is the situation where there could have been several burglaries or even several shopliftings that weren't related, and he's on bail on some and not on bail on the others. Some charges are just dismissed, but they're not read yet.
Right.
It is not our position that Mr. Floyd or anyone else would be entitled to sentence credit simply because they had spent time in jail on some charge. We're not asking the state to go through and pick out, you know, did this person ever spend time in jail? Because if he did, we want to credit it. You know, it has to be connected, and we believe that there's a bright line connection that can be made. When a case is part of the plea bargain, and when it's dismissed and read in for sentencing, that's a bright line situation when the court should say, yes, this person's entitled to sentence credit. If I can just touch on the equal protection argument, again, this court is well aware of the development of cases through Klimas and the fact that this is a developing area of the law. But what the court said is that basically we're going to look not at a double jeopardy analysis. We're going to look at if this person was treated differently, was penalized more severely because of poverty. And if in this case, if you took two people who went through the same circumstances in 1997 that Mr. Floyd went, a wealthy person who could have posted bail would have spent 157 days less than Mr. Floyd. And that, I believe, invokes the equal protection argument. I want to point out in particular that Mr. Floyd is now in a minimum security prison and he's about to be paroled. If he had been given 157 days of sentence credit, he would have been released by now. We are asking this court to create a bright line ruling on the issue of sentence credit so that no other inmate will have to spend 2 years fighting for his sentence credit.
When is he up for parole?
He expects to see the parole board in January, and to be paroled. He's met all of his program requirements. He has no conduct reports. I had been hoping that we might get this resolved before he was released, but it's probably not going to happen. However, it's important. It's important not just for Mr. Floyd, but for all other inmates in similar situations. We're asking that sentence credit be granted as a matter of right in any case where sentence credit has accrued on a charge that is dismissed as part of a plea bargain and read in for sentencing on another charge. This is the bright line that we're asking. This ruling will not only provide justice for Mr. Floyd, it will provide a sound public policy for the state of Wisconsin. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leifert. Laura M. Herman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Herman.
May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman, representing the state of Wisconsin. The state's core contention in this appeal is that Mr. Floyd is not entitled to the sentence credit he seeks under any of the three alternative grounds he raises. First, the sentence credit statute does not provide for sentence credit on a charge that is dismissed and read in at sentencing on another offense. Second, there is no equal protection violation in denying sentence credit on a charge that is read in. And third, Mr. Floyd's trial counsel were not ineffective for failing to improperly manipulate the bail and bond statutes in an effort to protect his sentence credit. I would like to directly respond to some of the issues that came up in Mr. Leeper's argument. Specifically, the first is, I believe the court is exactly right that the Beiersdorf case talked about this language in connection with and found that it needs to be a factual connection, not a mere procedural connection, which is all that we have in this case. The only way that the armed robbery custody is at all connected to the reckless endangerment offense for which he was sentenced is if it's by virtue of a procedural relationship.
Let me ask you about that, Don. Just from an ordinary understanding, it seemed to me that Judge Dahlberg, used that armed robbery lead-in decision as part of his sentencing. I mean, that's what it was there for. Why isn't that in connection or attributed to some part of the sentencing procedure? It's for sentencing purposes.
Yes, it is by virtue of being a charge that's read in at sentencing. The court can consider it when it is imposing sentence. However, mere consideration of a charge doesn't mean that the defendant was actually sentenced. No sentence was imposed for the read-in charge. By virtue of the nature of a read-in offense, the law in Wisconsin is that no sentence is actually imposed for a read-in charge. And the language of the sentence credit statute requires that the custody be in connection with conduct for which sentence is actually imposed. And the state's position is exactly that. There was no sentence imposed on this read-in charge.
Are you familiar with the Austin case that counsel cited?
I mean, yes.
And Melissa, and I have not read that case, but it seemed to me that that would take, would indicate that the case would allow for an admission or, let's say, a use of that in the course of conduct. Is that incorrect as far as the Austin case?
I don't believe that is incorrect. I believe that's correct, that when a charge is considered at sentencing, it is something the court can look to when imposing sentence on the crime of conviction. And that's another point I would like to make, is that Mr. Lieber's argument can't just be limited to read-in offenses, which is what he's asking for in this case. because it's not just read-ins that can be considered at sentencing. There are lots of other things that a court can consider at sentencing, whether it be pending charges, dismissed charges, charges for which a defendant was acquitted. All of those things can be considered at sentencing. And the problem is, if this court determines that because a read-in offense is something that can be considered at sentencing, that in and of itself is the reason a defendant should be entitled to sentence credit. We open the floodgates to any time an offense is considered at sentencing, a defendant should be entitled to credit for any time spent in custody on that offense. And there are a few problems related to that, because if that's true, that mere consideration of a charge is enough for there to be a connection for purposes of sentence credit, then sentencing courts are going to try and have to figure out whether or not, if a charge is considered at sentencing, they're going to have to figure out whether or not sentence credit was already granted for that offense, because conduct that can be considered at sentencing can be considered in multiple cases, in multiple sentencings. And a defendant, this court has said, a defendant is not entitled to dual credit. So it's going to be extremely difficult for sentencing courts to try and figure out, well, okay, was this conduct for which the defendant was in custody, was this already considered in some other context?
But as a practical matter, won't the district attorney take that into account, negotiating a plea bargain, and move the court take that into account in determining the sentence? Just as a practical
matter. I guess I'm not sure I understand exactly what your question is.
If the court is confronted with a situation in which there's a read-in, and the court says, well, I think, and the court says to himself or herself, I think you should get 3 years. If, in fact, there's time served, give you 3 years and 2 months, or 3 years and 6 months.
The problem with that, and if my understanding of the law is correct, is a court is supposed to sentence a defendant first and consider sentence credit second. So the court, technically at least, is not supposed to figure out, okay, now how much time is this really going to amount to in light of the credit he may get. The court is supposed to exercise its discretion on imposing sentence for the reasons it's allowed to, and then after that is done, the sentence is actually imposed, comes at the end of the sentencing hearing, how much sentence credit is actually due.
How do we explain time served sentences then?
I'm not sure I understand.
That's a very commonplace phenomenon in criminal court, particularly on the lower end of the spectrum, for example, in misdemeanors, but also in some low-level felonies where the sentence recommendation will be time served and the judge has to know how much time has been served at the front end of the hearing rather than the back end.
Right. If that's the recommendation, then obviously the court is going to have to know that that's the amount that was actually served prior to conviction and sentencing.
Let me just ask you about your floodgate argument. I still didn't understand exactly what floodgates this is going to open, because normally the judge is aware of the fact that the defendant has spent time in jail and how much time, and that's is not that part of the pre-sentence investigation? Isn't that there?
I believe it is often, I don't know if in every case, but it's often in the PSI, yes.
So what is the, you're saying the floodgates, what is the problem?
My argument is this, essentially. This court cannot simply limit its holding to read-in offenses, because read-ins are not the only offenses that a court can consider at sentencing. A court can also...
Well, we could say read-in, and that would be it. I mean, if that's a bright-line rule of the
Yes, you could say that, but I believe the very next day after your decision comes out, a defendant could go into court and make the argument, well, This conduct, for which I spent time in custody, was also considered at sentencing. Even though it wasn't a read-in, it's something that was considered at sentencing, and so I should get credit for that on this offense for which I've now been sentenced. Even if the defendant was acquitted of that earlier conduct, that can still be considered by a court at sentencing.
Could you just give me an answer on the floodgates, if you can think of one? You made an argument.
That is my argument, essentially, that it can't just be limited to read-ins, because read-ins aren't the only thing that are considered at sentencing. It would have to be opened up. Sentence credit would then have to be granted every time other conduct is considered at sentencing, whether it's uncharged conduct, a pending case in another county or in another court, or an offense for which the defendant was, or charges that were dismissed, or charges for which the defendant was acquitted. That's the floodgate that I'm talking about. It can't just be limited to read-ins.
So let me put this into a concrete fact situation to test your argument. An accused has been charged with reckless endangering safety while armed with a dangerous weapon, and he is charged and is released on a personal recognizance bond, just like here. There are several other judges. While on bond, several days, a month later, the accused is arrested for armed robbery, just like here.
Right.
The armed robbery case goes forward first, and the accused is then sentenced to 5 years in prison, just like here, right?
On the armed robbery under your hypothetical?
We can do it.
Because there is no sentence on the armed robbery.
You're right. We can do it on assault, on the recklessly endangering safety while armed. I want to stay with this.
Okay.
And it's 5 years.
Okay.
There is no plea agreement about dropping the reckless endangerment case. That's still pending. And he's still in jail for that. Right? During sentencing, can the pre-sentence investigation report and the prosecuting attorney say he should get a maximum sentence or very high because he's also engaged in armed robbery? Is an outstanding charge not yet tried?
A court can consider that as part of the defendant's character or the need to protect the public.
And in giving sentence, whether he's going to give him 5 years or whatever.
Right, right.
And then he'll get credit for the time he spent on that first charge.
Right, if it's something.
Spent it.
Right.
All right. Now he's going to be prosecuted for the second offense, right? He can do that, right? Reckless armed robbery.
Right.
So there's been no reading.
Right.
And he's then given a second sentence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the second sentence, if I understand your argument, only on that second sentence for that offense would you give him jail credit in the fact situation I gave you.
Trying to make sure I follow exactly.
It's the exact same case. It's just no read-in.
Right. If it's the exact same case and there's no read-in, the court still could have considered the conduct on the armed robbery. And still could have, I mean, the sentence could have come out the same way. The reason I make that argument is I think what will happen then, if it will be increasingly difficult for courts to keep track of whether this considered conduct was sentencing.
I'm trying to prove your point. So they may drop the armed robbery charge, at which point he spent X amount of days in jail because of this second offense, right? And he never gets credit for it. It's just dropped. Or they can prosecute, sentence, and he'll get credit if he sentenced.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But it's possible if they just drop the charge, don't read it in, no credit.
Right, he won't get that time.
That's your position.
Right.
Your position is if you start giving credit for everything that's considered, then there may be five other offenses around on various states.
Right, and they may have already been considered somewhere else, so in order to avoid giving double, triple, quadruple credit, keep giving credit for this same conduct, that's considered, because it can be considered, if a defendant has 10 cases out there, this same conduct can be considered in all 10 of those cases, and a defendant should not be entitled to credit in every single one of those for that same period of custody.
Yeah, but the difference is he's made an admission, and double jeopardy applies in a read-in.
Actually, that's a point of clarification that I would like to make. It's not double jeopardy that precludes the state. It's due process notions of fundamental fairness. It's because there's this agreement between the parties. As part of the plea agreement, the prosecutor says, if you plead to this, I'll dismiss this charge and agree to read it in to bar further prosecution. If the state goes ahead and then tries to prosecute on that charge, it promised it would read in and not prosecute. It's basically violating the agreement. It isn't double jeopardy necessarily. But
it doesn't matter as to the end result. No second prosecution.
Right, right. And a few other points that I would like to touch on, too. Mr. Leeper talked quite extensively about the Zarkowitz case, and basically we don't think that's all that relevant to the situation we have here, because Zarkowitz is dealing with language in the restitution statute. What does victim of any crime mean? In that case, the court was not looking at what is in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed mean. And the court had very specific reasons for reading the restitution statute, the language victim of any crime or any victim of the crime. They had reasons for reading it broadly, and the purpose behind the restitution statute is to make the victims whole, and it just really doesn't lend itself all that well to, it's just not all that relevant to what's going on in this case, the language of the sentence credit statute.
Do you agree with the way that your opposing counsel is reading the statute with regard to the second sentence? He says the second sentence really has no application in this case.
I believe his reading of it is correct in the sense that my understanding of the second sentence is that it's just a modification of the first, that it is sort of further defining custody as these other things.
So, in other words, if we would take the second sentence, which says custody includes without limitation by enumeration confinement related to an offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced. Let's take that phrase and put it in lieu of custody. That's what custody means. So it reads, confinement related to an offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed.
It's a little doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, I'm the first to admit this is not the most artfully drafted statute in the world. But I did go look to see if there's any legislative history that sheds some light on what the second sentence is, and there isn't a whole lot, but based on the Beiersdorf case, they talk about related to, they use that phrase, which is from the second sentence, and they sort of interchange it with in connection with, so it seems that at least the Beiersdorf court thought they were interchangeable on some level, and same with the last part of that second sentence also talks about, or for any other sentence arising out of the same course of conduct. The Court of Appeals, in the case of State versus Tusher, a very recent decision, basically equated that language of the second sentence with the language of the first sentence. And I did look at legislative history, and there was a legislative council note to the act that created the sentence credit statute, which states that it indicates that the statute was created to provide a convicted offender with credit towards his or her sentence for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which the sentence was imposed. If you look at the drafting file, that's the only language they really ever talk about. There's no mention of this second sentence. So It's my understanding, and it makes sense to at least say that it means the same thing. It's just sort of a further clarification. And in part, it seems to allow for sentence credit in situation where the custody may not have been caused by the specific crime for which sentence is imposed. For example, a lesser included offense. The defendant may be in custody on armed robbery, but then is later convicted of theft. The legislature wanted to make sure that just because what you were actually in custody for was armed robbery, but you're convicted of theft for that very same thing, you should still get credit for that time. You shouldn't be denied credit just because, you know, you happen to be convicted of some other offense, a lesser included offense.
I don't know what the second sentence really, how much it can help, because it talks about includes without limitation by enumeration. So if you happen to fall within those two aspects of that second sentence, lucky you, you're in.
Right.
But if you don't fall within those two classifications, it doesn't mean anything because it's not an exclusive listing.
Right. It doesn't appear to be all that helpful, and it's just not all that clear.
In analyzing the first sentence, if you assume actual days spent in custody means all days spent in custody.
Right. And I looked at that many times thinking I was reading it incorrectly, but I'm assuming that the actual days spent in custody was supposed to be all days spent in custody or whatever the language exactly is in the first sentence, but perhaps it was just a drafting error. I'd also like to mention that the rule of lenity, which Mr. Floyd's counsel is arguing for, only comes into play at the end of the line. It's not as if because this is a criminal statute, it ought to be applied broadly. It only comes into play if this court finds that the statute is ambiguous and if, after looking at all other sources to try and figure out what this sentence or what this statute means, only then should the court decide, well, it's ambiguous, we've looked at everything else, we can't really figure out what it means, so we'll give it a broad interpretation.
Do you concede it's ambiguous? Or do you just concede that it's inartfully drafted?
Inartfully drafted, but I think...
And just then tell me the difference.
Well, I think the inartfully drafted part comes in at the second sentence, which even Mr. Leeper says is irrelevant here. So we're all just dealing with the first sentence, and I think it's plain that you only get credit if the custody stems from the act for which sentence is actually imposed, and no sentence was imposed on the armed robbery because you are not sentenced for a read-in offense, which brings me to another point. The course of conduct language does not mean criminal episode. It has been severely narrowed by the Court of Appeals in the recent case of State versus Tusher, which this court denied a petition for review in that case. However, in that case, which is cited in my brief in a footnote, the Court of Appeals concluded that course of conduct does not mean criminal episode. It means the specific act. So it's... Even if... charges arise out of the same criminal episode in the sense of, you know, all of this is kind of going on at one time, that in and of itself is not enough to meet the terms course of conduct. That in and of itself doesn't mean you're going to get sentence credit for it.
Ms. Herman, let me ask you something from a public policy point of view. We've got very crowded jails, very crowded prisons. Given that fact, why shouldn't we interpret this language broadly in order to allow for credit in this case?
Because I don't believe the language of the statute allows you to do so. And if any change needs to come to the language of the statute to provide for it, it would need to come from the legislature.
Well, we're sort of guessing, are we not, as to what the legislative intent was? There's no clear legislative history. We're arguing over whether or not the language is ambiguous. And if it is ambiguous, we look at all kinds of things like scope and context and and other matters of that similar ilk. But do we not also look at public policy? And why shouldn't we favor giving credit in this particular situation?
Because I don't think credit is warranted for the reasons I've talked about. I think it...
Well, what public policy are we serving by interpreting the statute narrowly rather than broadly?
I guess basically that's a question that I don't have an answer to, but I'd be happy to address that at a later point.
In your opinion, if we were to define in connection with broadly enough to include a read-in, and if we were to define course of conduct broadly enough to include a read-in, would we have to overrule Beiersdorf and Tuscher?
I believe you would, because in those cases, they did find a
they
very narrow read-in.
They defined those phrases, and they defined them narrowly. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I believe that is correct. Justice Crooks, I'd be happy to submit something further on that. I just don't have anything off the top of my head on that issue.
That's okay. I understand.
How about people? I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Sure. How does your interpretation of 973-155 square with the philosophy of truth in sentencing?
Well, I think it remains to be seen exactly how sentence credit comes into play with truth in sentencing. It's my understanding, and I'm not an expert on truth in sentencing, but it's my understanding that that's something that is going to need to be addressed. And I don't know the answer to that at this point. I think there are still some things that are being worked out with truth in sentencing and its implementation as to exactly how sentence credit and maybe other statutes are going to be affected. I think it's something the legislature may have to take a look at.
How about your equal protection argument?
Sure.
How do you distinguish Klimas?
Well, I don't believe that this court can just look to Klimas, because Klimas, there was a case that came before that, which is Byrd versus State. And in that case, the court held that sentence credit must be granted for time spent in custody due to indigency, but only if that time in custody was a result of the criminal charge for which sentence is imposed, which very neatly tracks the language that the legislature later added in the creation of a sentence credit statute. Even under an equal protection analysis, a defendant is only entitled to credit for custody that is if there is a sentence imposed for the offense for which the offender was in custody. And in Klimas versus State, the court did not in any way alter its earlier language in Byrd versus State.
Is it correct to say that, though, that Klimas does not, on its face, doesn't limit its decision to any kind of specific course of conduct?
I'm not sure if I understand exactly.
I understood your argument to suggest that Klimas is, by it, the earlier decisions, is limited to a specific course of conduct. Now, maybe I misunderstood your argument.
No, I think that's true, because that's what the earlier case of Byrd said.
But I don't think Klimas, I don't think the written opinion of Klimas, and I just looked over quickly, limits itself to any specific course of conduct. I don't think it's that limiting in
language. It doesn't necessarily say that, no, but I think it has to be read in context with Byrd. But also, I think this court needs to consider where this whole equal protection notion in the context of sentence credit came from. And it came from the U.S. Supreme Court case law. And in the context of those cases, the way the equal protection analysis came in It was based on a notion that an indigent person should not have to serve a longer sentence on an offense than a non-indigent person solely because of his or her inability to post bail on that offense. It's always, we're still talking about this offense. An indigent person should not have to serve a longer sentence on an offense just because they couldn't post bail on that offense.
And yet, again, I have not read the case carefully, but I look at some language that we conclude that henceforth and in the instant case, all pre-sentence confinement because of indigency must be applied toward the diminution of the sentence imposed. Now, that's a one-sentence paragraph, nothing before it, nothing after it. And that seems much broader than you're saying as to a specific offense, sentence imposed.
The language itself could be read that way, but I think it still has to be read in the context of where this whole equal protection notion came from in the first place. And I think the defendant's reading of the equal protection clause is too broad. Nothing about equal protection requires sentence credit for considered offenses, and equal protection does not require total equality. And in this case, Mr. Floyd is not serving a longer sentence on the reckless endangerment due to his inability to post bail. He is served, the only course of conduct for which sentence was imposed was for reckless endangerment, and he's not serving any longer sentence because the time he spent in custody on the armed robbery really has nothing to do with that. So it links to our statutory construction argument.
So the armed robbery, if I've heard you right, had just nothing to do with his sentence. It may just as well not have been read in.
Right. It had nothing to do. It's something a court can look at when it's imposing sentence, but there is no sentence imposed by virtue of it being read in.
Yeah, so you can't say it had nothing to do with his sentence. You can say that factually it had nothing to do with the facts of for the offense for which he was sentenced.
Right.
But you can't say that
that's,
it has nothing
true.
To do with his
that's,
sentence.
That is true. Are there any further questions? If not, the state would ask this court to affirm the trial court's decision to not grant Mr. Floyd any further sentence credit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herman. Mr. Leeper, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to begin by addressing the question of whether we're asking this court to open the floodgates to all kinds of sentence credit for every imaginable subject mentioned during sentencing. I think this is the position that the state has suggested. And it's true that when a court sentences somebody, it can look back 20 years and it can say, yes, this person's been involved in criminal activity. There's 10 cases on the record. But there is not the double jeopardy implication that comes with consideration of those kind of cases. When a case is read in for sentencing under Wisconsin law, and again, it's the Evans case, I believe, that means that the defendant admits the charges and, in some sense, sufficient to justify double jeopardy protection, is being punished for that charge. I don't see any way that this court is going to be opening the floodgates to this kind of double jeopardy protection. Another issue brought up by the state that, you know, asking the court to be concerned about is the question of multiple credit. Again, in the situation that the Chief Justice presented, where say Mr. Floyd would have been convicted on the reckless endangering first and would have gotten a 5-year sentence, and then later they would have dismissed or been convicted, it doesn't matter, on that charge of armed robbery. There's no way that Mr. Floyd could get sentence credit on two different cases. That's clearly been established by the Supreme Court, and You know, we're not asking for that in this case, and neither are we asking for a decision or a public policy that would allow that. There's clear case law that says you're not entitled to dual credit in any situation. You know, and there's many situations that are closer than this one could ever get. In terms of legislative history, I would like to point out I've had time to take a look at something that was in the legislative history file. It's a letter to Representative McClain, who's from the chairman of the Assembly Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee. It's a letter by William Gansner, and it points out, first thing it addresses is the question of retroactivity. The statute in the late 70s was going to say you should get sentence credit, but it can't be retroactive. Mr. Gansner is pointing out in this letter that the legislature can't do that. The Supreme Court has already said this is an equal protection issue. The indigent defendants are entitled to this. And I think that is a crucial consideration when the state asks this court to say that sentence credit can only be provided as authorized by statute. That's simply not accurate. Sentence credit has been authorized by courts for many years. It was authorized long before this statute was passed in the late 70s. And the courts have the power and ability to grant sentence credit without any statutory authority. You know, the purpose of 973.155 is to try to clarify and codify this particular situation. It does not change the inherent power of the court to recognize sentence credit or to apply equal protection to defendants in that situation. I would also note that Mr. Gansner says, I'm confident that Senate Bill 159, with the changes I have suggested, will bring fair and hopefully final resolution to an area of law that has been too long characterized by arbitrariness and confusion. I agree that sentence credit was characterized by arbitrariness and confusion. I grew up as a district attorney in that particular area when these things were changing, but I don't believe that we come to final resolution of that particular issue, at least not until the court decides this case. So I ask and encourage you to make a decision first because of statutory interpretation. I think that's the easiest and the most direct way to make a decision. The second basis for the decision is equal protection. The third basis, which I haven't had much time to discuss, is ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't have time to touch on that at all.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lieber, and thank you, Ms. Herman, and it's been pointed out to me that this is our last oral argument in the year of 1999, barring some unforeseen event. But of course, as we all know, and as a court, we have many unforeseen events. So I will see you all on November 10th, 2000.
Last argument of the millennium.
Well, I don't want to talk about whether it's the last argument of the millennium, because there's a dispute as to when the millennium starts, and I don't want to have that debated. I'm tabling my choice of words for actual days, excluding all days. So with that, we are adjourned till January 6th.